Okay, hi, good morning, everybody. Good to see you, and thank you for coming. Baruch Hashem, we're still going through the difficult struggles, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu should show us Nitzachon. It's really kind of touching that even when you're sitting on the bus, they make announcements that, you know, we're with you all the way. You know, it's kind of nice, the sense that in this difficult time, there is so much Achdus, there is so much Avat Yisrael. And as I've said many times already, this is the silver lining in our dark clouds. And the hope would be that even when things get better, which we hope will be very, very soon, we'll hold on to the Achdus and the Avat Yisrael that we learned during this difficult time. That would be the bracha that would come out of these difficult situations. Obviously, you also know, everyone knows this, that the war has taken a very, very difficult turn. We've lost more Chayolim just in the past few days than in the entire, since October 7th. And therefore, the Chayolim and the hostages that remain in captivity certainly need our tefillos. More, they always needed it, and they always need it, but more than usual. And our Torah should be dedicated for their Hatzalah, their Yeshua. In addition, I want to announce that our shir for the entire year is dedicated by Rav Rafael and Sharon Aumann in memory of their parents, Edith and Reiner Aumann, Zichrono Livracha, Yaina Ben Sadak, and Esther Bas Rafael, as well as in Lezecher Nishmas, their son, Harav Shmuel Eliyahu ben Harav Rafael. Again, we very much appreciate the generosity. May it be a zechus and aliyat neshama for their parents and for their son. And today, the entire day of Torah learning, all of the shiurim together, are in loving memory of a mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, Bessie Lebor, Le'ili Nishmas Basha Bas Pesach, by Rina and Yaakov Kaufman, and David Lebor and Talia Eisenstein. So again, we're very grateful. This should be Le'iloi Eloi Nishmata. We're kind of always in the middle of a topic, but I do have to digress. I don't think I mentioned this. It's such an amazing little thought. It's really connected to Asara B'Tebes, but I'm going to take the license a little bit of going backwards. We know that last Friday, last Erev Shabbat, we had the fast of Asara B'Tebes. But it's actually recorded in the Mikoros that there were tzaddikim that would fast 3 days in a row. They would fast the 8th of Teves, the 9th of Teves, and the 10th of Teves. They would eat at night, but they would actually fast 3 days in a row. And we know that the 10th of Teves is the only fast that is mandatory, right? The other ones are not mandatory, but Tzaddikim would fast those 2 extra days. And the Slichos of Asara B'Teves makes reference to a 3-day fast. But the 3 days have nothing to do with each other. On the 10th of Teves was the day, as you know from last week, that Nebuchadnezzar began his siege against Jerusalem, which culminated in the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash 3 years and a few months later. The 8th of Teves is a later event. That was the day that the 72 elders completed the translation of the Torah into Greek. You know the story, that one of the successors of Alexander in Egypt, Talmai, P-T-O-L, M-E-Y, Talmai in Hebrew, had what was like the National Library or the Library of Congress. He wanted every single book in the world. Of course, there weren't that many books then, but every single book in the world to be in his library, to be translated in the language that was spoken then, which was Greek. And therefore, he commissioned 72 sages, and he put them in separate rooms, and he directed that they translate the Torah into Greek. And we actually have this. This is called the Septuagint, which is Greek for the translation of the 70, although technically there were 72. And the Gemara in Megillah tells us, miraculously, even though they were put in separate rooms and they weren't talking to each other, they came up with exactly the same translation, including deviations, as I'll indicate. Of course, I once heard that if they would have been in the same room and they would have come up with the same thing, that would have been a bigger miracle. because Jews always fight when they're together. But still, the Gemara gives a few examples of deviations from literalness that they did. For example, the very first three words of the Torah, Bereshit bara Elokim. Now, if you translate them hyper-literally, the syntax in Hebrew would be, the beginning created God, implying that God was created. So they inverted it to say, God created the beginning. Or another example it mentions, that when the Torah lists unkosher or non-kosher animals, so it mentions the arnevet. The arnevet is a rabbit. A rabbit is a non-kosher animal. Now, apparently, the Greek for rabbit is the name of Talmai's wife, which I think is Bernice. I think Bernice actually means rabbit in Greek. And therefore, if they would have said, Bernice is treif, Bernice is not kosher, that would have been a big insult to the queen. So instead, they used a euphemistic expression for rabbits, such as that creature that dwells in the rocks or whatever it would be. They were Mishana. They were Mishana, various things. Now, what do Chazal say? Chazal say, the day that the Torah was translated into Greek, it was finished on the 8th of Tebes. The world was filled with darkness, and the righteous fast on that day because of the awful thing that happened. So the question is, what's so awful? I mean, the Torah was translated into a language. I mean, it was the art scroll of the time. There were many, many Jews who actually, unfortunately, could not read Hebrew. This helped them. In fact, Philo of Alexandria, who lived in Alexandria, actually records an interesting thing, that the 8th of Tevis was a Yom Tov in Alexandria, because it was the day that everyone got access to the Torah. So the very thing that the Alexandrian Jews considered to be a simcha, the Chachamim of Eretz Yisrael, our Chachamim, considered to be a tragedy. By the way, just as a little aside, although the Septuagint, the Targum HaShivim, which is called, was translated by people who were considered to be chazal, rabbis, nevertheless, it never really entered the Jewish Masorah. Now, we have Targum Onkelos, we have other things, but the Targum HaShivim did not have a great influence on halachic Judaism. It was, however, extremely influential in Christianity, meaning some of the church fathers knew Hebrew, many of them knew Hebrew, but a lot of them learnt the Old Testament, as they called it, via the Septuagint. So the Septuagint, although it is a Jewish work, was much more significant in the history of Christianity than it was in Judaism. And, you know, if you have a Septuagint, you can actually get it online as well, you will actually see that it's on other books of the Bible as well, but that came later, meaning the original Septuagint of Talmai was only the Chamisha Chumtei Torah. The other books are different people, etc., and therefore it's not really the same work. So the question is, why is this such a tragedy? What is so gefelich? So there are different reasons you can offer. There are three reasons that commentaries offer. Reason number one is that by translating it, you're making it accessible to the non-Jewish world. And once the non-Jewish world has possession of the Torah, they could then introduce different distortions and the like. So it would have been better not to give the Goyim, so to speak, access to the Torah. That's reason number one. So the concern would be accessibility to the non-Jewish world. Of course, today it is accessible in a million translations, right? But that was one of the first. The second reason is an interesting paradox. I remember when the very first art scroll came out. I don't know if you remember this. This goes back to like 1977 or 75. I don't remember. It was on Megillas Esther. And it was so interesting. Art scroll was a, Rav Meir Zlatowitz, Zichrono Livracha, was a graphic artist. And he did Kasuvos and Ventures. I think Art Scroll still has a division, but that was the Art Scroll business. And he lost a friend. And he thought he would do a one-time thing, Lezecher Nishmas, his friend, he would do a Megillas Esther with anthologized English commentaries. It was absolutely intended to be a one-time event that was for Shloshim. For Shloshim. And that would be it. Then he would go back to the wedding invitation and Ksuva business. And the rest is history, of course. Art Scroll became a gigantic thing, maybe the biggest Harbatzas Torah in the history, since Moshe Rabbeinu, since the history of the world. And again, I know that people, you can have all sorts of criticisms in art school, there are many, many different criticisms, but you cannot deny the impact they have had on Torah learning. It is phenomenal. Yeah, it's not perfect. Only God is perfect, that's true. But just tremendous thing. Now, I remember, So I remember in 1977, there was the Jewish Observer, still publishing, and somebody said, what a great simcha it is that now, we have English translations that give rabbinic literature and makoros, and now everybody could read what Chazal say and the Mefarshim say. So someone said, well, is it such a simcha? Remember the translation of the Torah into Greek. Meaning, we actually have two feelings about this. It's very, very interesting. On one hand, we rejoice when Jews who cannot read Hebrew or go to the originals are able to see the wisdom of Torah. On the other hand, we're very sad that so many Jews are not able to go back in Lashon HaKodesh and understand things. It's like crutches. If I ask you the question, are you happy that there are crutches and wheelchairs in the world? Well, it kind of depends on how you ask the question. If people are going to have broken legs, I am very, very grateful that there are crutches and wheelchairs in the world. But if the choice would be that people wouldn't have broken legs, that would have been better. So on one hand, it's a great simcha. On the other hand, there's a certain sara that we're not able, because remember, Chazal say there are 70 faces to the Torah. Now, a translation, by definition, cannot pick up all of them, maybe one of them, So by definition, no matter how good a translation is and a commentary, there's so much you're going to miss. And I have to say, too, that Alexandria was an extremely wealthy Jewish community, and an extremely assimilated Jewish community, kind of like many parts of the United States. Ad kedei kach, that some say Philo, who was a very learned person and a religious Jew, whatever that meant then exactly, may not have known how to read Hebrew himself. Some have said this. The jury is out on that particular question. And there's some evidence that even the Kriyas HaTorah was in a Torah written in Greek. That's why, when you learn Maseches Megillah, the Gemara discusses, is a Torah scroll kosher if it's written in Greek? And I always thought to myself when I learned that, who on earth would ever think of writing a Torah scroll in Greek? Why would that question come up? The answer is, it actually may have happened in Alexandria and the like. So that's the second reason. I'm sorry, did you want to say? Yeah.
I just wanted to say that I was going to do this.
Yep. Wow, that's amazing. So it's 100% true. Rav Meir Fogel, Zichrono Livracha, was the impetus for Rav Meir Zlotowitz to do the art school on Megillat Esther. And from Megillat Esther, it spread to everything, to Shas, Bavli, Yerushalmi, Medrash, Ein Yaakov, and more and more projects every single day, even cookbooks, but those maybe would be of lesser importance. But Art Scroll branches out. Spencer, yes, but Art Scroll branches out to all of those different things. So those are two reasons so far that there was a tainus. One is accessibility to the goyim. The second is bemoaning the fact that in an assimilated Jewish community, people were not capable of reading the Torah, Belashon HaKodesh. And the third reason, I think, is a bit more subtle, and that is the Chachamim found it necessary to introduce certain deviations from the literal text. Now, they had good reasons for it, but that creates a real dangerous precedent, because once you kind of give yourself a license to deviate from the text, then God forbid. Now, again, halakhically, nothing was affected when they did it, but people could use it as a precedent to delete things from the Torah that are not comfortable. So when the Torah says in Vayikra about not having Mishkav Zachor, let's take that one out, it's not. So maybe Chazal saw with Ruach HaKodesh that this was a very dangerous notion of tampering with something, even though it may have been innocuous when they did it, but it could lead to very drastic consequences. So that is the fast of the 8th of Teves. And that is after the event of the 10th of Teves, right? The 10th of Teves was surrounding the city before the Churban. This is already during the Second Temple, during the Bayit Sheni. Okay. We then have a fast of the 9th of Teves. What is that about? So here, the Makairis of the Brisa say a very strange thing. The 9th of Teves was proclaimed a fast as well, but the Chachamim didn't want to tell you why. Very, very strange. We're not telling. Well, that's pretty strange. Now, in the Slichais, it says, the 9th of Teves was the yahrzeit of Ezra HaSefer. Now, Ezra HaSefer was the leader of the Jewish people, the spiritual leader. There's a book of Ezra at the very beginning of the Second Temple. He was the founder of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the men of the Great Assembly, the 120 elders who essentially revitalized Judaism upon the Shivat Zion, the return after the Babylonian exile. Ezra was considered to be so great that Chazal consider him a second Moshe Rabbeinu. And they actually declare, if the Torah would not have been given via Moshe Rabbeinu, Ezra was worthy enough to be the one that was Mekabel the Torah. And Ad Kedei Kach, therefore, the same way Tzadikim fast on the 7th of Adar, which is Moshe Rabbeinu's yahrzeit, there were Tzadikim who fasted on the yahrzeit of Ezra HaSofer. Well, that's a perfectly good reason, but the problem is, why would that be a mystery? In other words, why would the Chachamim say, we're not going to tell you why it's a fast, if it's simply the yahrzeit of Ezra HaSofer? There's no secret about that, per se. So because of this, Mefarshim have uncovered all sorts of other mysterious reasons why some people fasted on the 9th of Teves. And when you hear these other reasons, you will understand why the Chachamim didn't want to talk about it. Reason number one, I guess I could say it's almost in Yonei Diyuma, is that according to some, the 9th of Teves was the Hebrew birth date of Yeshu HaNachri, of Yashka, Jesus of Nazareth, which actually fits if you go back to the year of his birth. The 9th of Teves was his birthday. His Hebrew. So it's interesting. So if someone asks you, you know, why don't Jews, you know, celebrate Christmas? You know, it's a stupid question, but, you know, the answer is we do commemorate Christmas. This is the fast. This is the fast of the 9th of Teves. We commemorate it by a fast, but, you know, we commemorate it. We you know, as it were. Now, obviously, the Chachamim, in light of the fact that Christianity was such a source of persecution for the Jewish people over centuries and centuries and centuries, so you could understand that the birth of Yeshu would be considered to be kind of a tragic event for us. But they didn't want to reveal it because that could cause a pogrom or whatever it would be, that we're fasting on the day of Yashka's birth. By the way, one other thing about Yashka I want to mention, because it is fascinating. You know, there are but there is considerable material in the Gemara and in the Medrash about Yeshu. Yeshua, his name is Yehoshua. The word Jesus is just Greek for Yehoshua. In fact, Yehoshua bin Nun in the Septuagint is Jesus, you know, son of Nun. So Jesus is not anything more than the Greek form of Yehoshua. The other word, Christ, one should not say in connection with that, because Christ means the Messiah, the anointed one. So it's the Christ that is the improper title to use. But the first name is just a first name. But we call him Yeshu. Yeshu is an abbreviation for Yimach Shemo V'Zichro. His name for Radigat or Yashka or whatever it is. That's not important. But he was, of course, Jewish. And there was a lot of material in the Gemara about it. But most of that material was censored by the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church employed apostate Jews, Jews who beshumet, and they gave them a directive that when you come across these different passages, take them out. And they censored it. And as a result, a lot of the passages were expunged. So you may ask, so now in the newer editions of Shas, they're put back in. So you may ask, how did they get recovered if all of them were expunged? So it's very, very interesting. because Sephardic Shasan, those that were printed in Syria, North Africa, which were under Islamic rule, didn't censor those passages. So essentially, the Ashkenazic Shasan were able to recover the passages via the Sephardic printings or manuscripts of Shas. So there is a story there which is really, really remarkable. The Gemara says, it's a famous Gemara, the teaching is a very famous teaching in Gemara. Le'olam tehe yamin mikareves usmol docha. This is very, very important. That in your relationship to your children and to your students, the right hand should draw near and the left hand should push away. Now, with apologies to lefties, Chazal always write with the assumption that the right hand is the stronger hand, the dominant hand, the more powerful hand. So Chazal are teaching us a very important concept about parenting and about teaching, that the dominant, most powerful influence that you have to have is one of kindness, friendship, love. There has to be discipline. There has to be responsibility. But that should be with the left. The pushing away should be the weaker response. The stronger response always has to be. In fact, a very well-known therapist in the Frum community, she writes for Mishpacha magazine too, Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, you may have come across her, very, very good, astute psychologist. She has an 80-20 rule, which I think most of us may not keep. She says, you try to get that 80% of your interactions with your children should be positive. She says, no more than 20% should be negative. Unfortunately, sometimes we might reverse the ratios. So that's a beautiful teaching. Yamin mikareves, smo doche. But of all things, it proves this from the story of Yashka. It mentions that Yeshu was a student of the Tana, Rav Yehoshua ben Parachia. He was a student. He was a Jew. He was a student of Torah. And he was once with his Rebbe at an inn. Now, the word for inn in Aramaic is ushpiza, like ushpizan, yes. But ushpiza can also mean a female innkeeper. So when they were sitting and having a meal at the inn, Rabbi Yeshua said, Kama no'eh ushpiza zu, which he meant to say, how beautiful is this inn? Yashka assumed he was saying how beautiful the innkeeper is, and he said, I think her eyes are too close together. So Rabbi Yeshua ben Parachi was kind of offended, number one, that Yashka is thinking about looking at the women, and number two, that he thinks that the Rebbe is looking at the women. So he kind of excommunicated him, and he said he's not going to talk to him for a number of days. And it mentions that for 40 days in a row, Yashka came to Rabbi Yeshua and begged forgiveness. And Rabbi Yeshua refused to accept it. He felt that Yashka needed the discipline. It was the last day. On the 48th day, Yashka said, this is the last time. If he doesn't accept me, I'm leaving this religion. And Rabbi Yehoshua had the same thought. If he comes to me today, I'm going to forgive him. But lo and behold, when Yashka came to ask Mechila, Rabbi Yehoshua is in the middle of saying the Shema. Now, I don't know why Yashka didn't notice that, but he says, and therefore he couldn't answer him. So Yashka said, that's it, I'm leaving. He went to Egypt. He learned magic and the occult arts. Now, it's fascinating that Chazal don't use this as a story to blame Yashka. They use it as a story to be a little critical of Yeshua ben Karacha. He was too harsh. He was too rejecting. Had he been a little bit more accepting, then Yashka wouldn't have gone out. L'tarbut ra'at. Quite an amazing story that Chazal used this as an example that the yamin should be mekarev, the small and the small be docha. Lo kirav Yeshua ben Parachia, who was docha b'shtei yadayim, he pushed him away with both hands. By the way, the last part of the passage is also significant. It says he went to Egypt to learn magic. Now we know, without getting into the issue, is there such a thing as magic? But the simple meaning of Chazal is, and the Torah is, that there is such a thing. The Torah talks about, of course, the Chartumei Mitzrayim, the magicians of Egypt. And if the idea is that Yeshko learned Kishuf, whatever that means exactly, that's an interesting point, because the Christian Bible records that Yeshko did all sorts of miracles. Now, how do we look at that? So people say, well, I don't believe it. You know, it's above a mitzvah, which is, no, that's entirely possible. But what's interesting is, it may theoretically be possible that we could accept that certain things were done, but they were done as kishuf, like the Chartume Mitzrayim. Meaning to say, the Gemara is actually telling us that you don't have to deny the historical reality of a miracle. It just didn't come from Hashem. Came from Kochos of Tuma, like the Chartumim. The Chartumim turned staffs into snakes, etc. So whatever. Now, whether that's real or whether that's an illusion, there's another question. That's a machlokas. Is magic a reality? Or is magic kind of hypnosis or illusion? Okay, that's an interesting machlokas. But whatever it is, that is what Yeshko got engaged in, right? So I know people discuss, I know with the Harry Potter books were, I don't know if they're still as popular as they were, but they were very, very, very popular books. And, you know, even among religious kids enjoyed the Harry Potter books. I enjoyed some of them, too, when my son was growing up. You know, so people say, are you allowed to read, you know, a Harry Potter book? It's about Hogwarts, it's Kishuf and everything else. Okay, but, you know, we could be makel because nobody takes it as a serious thing. It's like Rav Moshe wrote about Greek mythology. Similarly, right? You know, when I was a kid, you know, in a day school, we read Greek and Roman mythology all the time. And the problem is, it's Avodah Zarah, Jupiter, Zeus, all these different things. So Rav Moshe gives a very interesting idea. Rav Moshe says that any reading about idolatry that nobody in the world takes seriously whatsoever is not Avodah Zarah anymore. So for me to read about Christianity, that would be a problem, because that's a religion that still has millions and millions of adherents, and God forbid, I don't want to be converted, you know, to that type of religion. But nobody is going to become a worshiper of Jupiter or whatever it is. So then it just becomes above a mice, it just becomes stories. So stories are stories. I mean, maybe they're Hevel, just the Hevel, but they wouldn't be considered to be Avodah Zarah anymore, because they're simply not a religion that anybody has. So the same thing would be true for Kishuf and the like. Okay, so Harry Potter is okay. By the way, I even have a chiddush that let's assume you got accepted to Hogwarts, but they didn't let you off for Shabbos. So are you allowed to do magic on Shabbos? So I have a raya from Tosfos. Tosfos says in Maseches Menachos that on the last day, well, I'm sorry, the Gemara says, on the last day of Moshe Rabbeinu's life, he actually wrote 13 Sifrei Torah, in which one was put in the Aron HaKodesh, and one was given to each Shevet. So Tosfos asks the Kasha, how could Moshe Rabbeinu write 13 Sifrei Torah the last day of his life? We have a tradition that Moshe Rabbeinu died on Shabbos. Right? So if Moshe died on Shabbos, how could he write Sefer Torah? So Tosfos says, since by definition, if he wrote 13 Sefer Torah, it must have been a supernatural miracle. Molacha that you do by supernatural miracles are not considered molachot for the laws of Shabbos. The Torah prohibits molacha b'derech hateva. It does not prohibit malacha lamala miderech hateva. So that would mean that, you know, Hogwarts, there may be an issur of kishuv, that's a separate issur, but you wouldn't be mechalel Shabbos by doing these tricks. Okay, but be it as it may, this is reason number one for the fast, or the mysterious reason number one of the fast of the ninth of Teves. It was the birthday of Yeshu HaNotzri. Again, Notzri, again, you understand, Notzri has become to mean Christian, but really Notzri originally just meant from Natseret, because Natseret was his place of birth. Okay. Now, there is a second reason that's even stranger, and that is, it is a yahrzeit, not a birthday, But it's the yahrzeit site of a man called Shimon Kippa. Shimon Kippa. And therefore we commemorate the death of Shimon Kippa by fasting. Now, who is Shimon Kippa? So keep in mind that the word Kippa in Aramaic, not in Hebrew, actually means a rock. Rock. Shimon the Rock. Okay, so rock is obviously a nickname. The Greek for rock is Petra. So Shimon Kippa is a man who was Simon Peter. Now, Simon Peter, as you know, his name was Shimon. He was Jewish, as all of Yeshka's Talmidim were, early Talmidim were. And his name was Shimon. And Yeshka designated Shimon as his successor, as his Memale Makam. Shimon eventually came to Rome and became the first bishop of Rome, which made him the first pope. Peter was the first pope. And Yeshka named him Peter because he says, "You are my rock. I can rely on you. You are the rock." Right? So Shimon Kippa is Simon Peter, the Apostle Peter. So why on earth? Now again, this is not saying we're fasting the day he was born. We're fasting the day he died. Like we're mourning him like a tzaddik. Why would we mourn Shimon Kippa? So here we have a medrash. Now, this is a very important point. The word medrash has a bit of an indefinite meaning. There are what you might call the official midrashim. The official midrashim, the Medrash Rabbah, the Medrash Tanchuma, Pirkei DeRabbi Eliezer, the Pesikta, the Yalkut Shimoni, which is really an anthology of Midrashim. These are the Midrashim that have the stamp of Chazal on them. These are like the Gemara. These are authoritative. Eino Chinami, it doesn't mean they have to be literal. That's an important point. Like if you were to ask me, do I have to believe that all Midrashim are true? The answer is, yes, every Medrash is true, but the definition of truth is not necessarily literal. See, it's a false dichotomy to say Midrashim are either true or they're not true. No, they're true, but they can be true in many, many senses. So, for example, do you have to believe that Vashti, you know, didn't go to the party because she grew a tail? Do I have to believe that Vashti had a tail? You actually don't. But the Medrash is expressing a certain metaphoric idea. So this is very important. All Midrashim are repositories of very, very deep truth. They're not Bubba Mises. They're not just things. But truth can be non-literal too. Truth can be symbolic. This is a point the Rambam himself makes. The Rambam makes in the Hakdama to Perek Chelek, the Rambam makes the point that there are some people who think all Midrashim are literally true, and there are some people who say if it offends their reason, it's false. And the Rambam says the first group are well-meaning idiots, and the second group are Rishayim because they have no respect for Chazal. And the truth is in the middle. All Midrashim are true, but truth can also be symbolic. Now, some are literal and some are symbolic. And the Rambam then promises us, talk about a lost opportunity, that he will write a book going through Midrashim and Agada. And he will explain which ones are meant to be taken literally and which ones are meant to be taken symbolically. He was going to write a book to that effect. Unfortunately, the book was never written. The Rambam was busy with other projects. So we don't have such a book of the Rambam. So that's a bit of a chaval. But those are what I call the canonical midrashim. Those are the official midrashim that we have to be makabel on one level or another. However, in the Middle Ages, there was a variety of other books that sometimes were given the name Medrash. And we don't really know who wrote them. And we don't really know how reliable they are. Different fragments of them are quoted by some Rishonim. So essentially, if Rashi quotes some of these fragments, we would assume that it's reliable. Many of the Midrashim about Chanukah, by the way, are that way. The Midrashim of Chanukah that are called Medrash are not really in the Medrash Rabbah or Tanchuma. In fact, there's a two-volume work. You'd even get it on HebrewBooks.org. It's called Otsar HaMidrashim. I think it's even still sold in the stores. It was put together by Rav Yehuda Eisenstein, a very interesting whole story, Rav on the Lower East Side going back to the 1920s and before, and he collected all of these odd fragments of Midrashim from all over the place, and he put it together in two volumes. You know, these are like 100 Midrashim. Each of them is like two pages or whatever it is. So in one of these unauthorized Midrashim, there is a story about Shimon Kippa. So is it true? Maybe not. I'm not saying it's true, but this is a story that is quoted in medieval sources. And that is, the early Christians were, of course, Jews. They were Jews. Yeshua was a Jew. And as a result, they davened in shuls. Many of them still kept mitzvahs, just like a Messianic Jew today. You know, he may be from, I mean, you have Messianic Jews who have a beard and payas and tzitzis and the like. Now, that posed a tremendous danger for the Jewish people. Because when you have people who subscribe to Christian beliefs, who are within the Jewish community itself, chas v'shalom, people could be poisoned, people could be influenced, just as indeed happens to this very day. Right? There were stories just last year, 2 years ago, about a couple that was living within the Frum community. That way. So Shimon Kippa proposed the following proposal to the Sanhedrin. He said, listen, I want to take Christianity out of Judaism. I want to make it a separate religion in which they're not going to be in our synagogues. They're not going to be in the shuls. They're not going to be in our communities. In fact, I will even cause them to hate the Jewish people. And in that way, they will be separated. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to become a follower of Yeshua, and I will establish a church. You know, I will establish like a separate religion. Now, he said, tragically, I know that I am cutting myself off from the Jewish community. This is Simon Peter. And I know that I'll never be able to be in the Jewish community again. But I am doing this in order to save Am Yisrael from being infiltrated by Christianity within the Jewish religion itself. And indeed, the Medrash goes on that he separated himself, he became Bishop of Rome, he created a separate Christian religion, a separate Christian church, as it were. It mentions that in private, he would continue to keep mitzvahs, he would wear tefillin in private and the like. But publicly, he actually attacked the Jewish people so that the Christians would not be connected to the Jewish people in any way. And in memory of a righteous person who essentially sacrificed his Jewish identity for the benefit of Klal Yisrael, some tzaddikim fasted on the 9th of Teves. But they didn't want to reveal the reason because, once again, it wouldn't be understood by the Jews. Like, why are you fasting for Shimon Kippa? Now, there's a second statement that's even more crazy, and that is, he also had one other request. He said, now remember my Yahrzeit? And he said, I composed a prayer. I composed a tefillah. Can you have this tefillah recited in your shuls? So that way, I'm still connected to the Jewish community. And the Medrash says the prayer that Shimon Kippa composed was Nishmas. The prayer of Nishmas, a beautiful tefillah that we say on Shabbos. And Nishmas is also one of those segula tefillahs. For example, Rebbetzin Kanievsky would often tell people who needed a shidduch or needed children or whatever it is, like, say Nishmas for 40 days. And you'll get skulas. So according to this Medrash, the author of Nishmas is none other than Shimon Kippa. Now, I want to point out that sometimes, now there is a sefer that was written by one of the Talmidim of Rashi. Rashi lived in France. Vitry, just a city in France, so Rav Simcha of Vitry compiled a book of minhagim of tefillah and nusach and yamtef and the like, and this is called Machzor Vitry. It's a very famous sefer, and Machzor Vitry has many, many of the minhagim of Rashi. So Rashi didn't write it, but a Talmud of Rashi wrote it and incorporated. Now you'll often see that Machzor Vitry is the source of the statement that Shimon Kippa is the author of Nishmas. So I need to correct that. It is true that in Machzor Vitry you will find a statement that some say Nishmas was written by Shimon Kippa, but Machzor Vitry says that's untrue. In other words, he says it and then says it's Chas V'Shalom. So I'm obviously not telling you anything that I know is factually true, meaning there are some sources that said such a thing, and there are some sources that say that's absolutely impossible, and Chas V'Shalom to say it. So I'm not saying it as a certainty, but it's such a fascinating bit of like obscure knowledge that I wanted to share it with you. Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting. I actually once heard this from my own Rosh Hashiva, Rav Yaakov Weinberg, and he said the great attraction was that, you know, in Judaism, we very much want to love God. We want to be connected to God. But God has no body. God is without physical dimensions. So it's very, very hard, actually. It takes a lot of work to connect to as a physical being, to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who has no physical essence. Christianity physicalized divinity. Now, that's a mistake. That's a distortion. It's not emes. But on an emotional gut level, it's enormously attractive in the sense that I have a God I can relate to. Now, of course, that's false. It's false. Right? You asked me what's the attraction, so I'm telling you what the attraction is. But that doesn't make it emes. All sorts of lot. Well, in fact, that was the attraction to Avodah Zarah itself. Kind of having physical images of the Egel Azov, to have a physical image of divinity. And Hashem says over and over again that, you know, you did not see a picture, you did not see an image. Right? Hashem warns us, you did not see it. Right? This is what Avodah Zarah is all about. But still, people have weakness, and there are things that are attractive. Now, it's interesting, I do want to point out that in the early years, I don't want to get too much into the history of Christianity, but in the early years of Christianity, there actually was a machlokas, do they have to keep the Torah? Meaning, there was a position that says, we got to keep the Torah. It was Paul. Now, Paul didn't even know Yashka. Paul was also a Jew. But Paul was the one who really said, we're not obligated to keep the Torah. Christians no longer obligated to keep the Torah. So that step of abrogating the Torah came later. That was not the initial thing. The initial point was you remained a Shomer Mitzvot, but you had this theology. Okay. So, as I say, it's a little odd that, you know, to speak about Inyone Diyuma that are connected to the secular date, but okay, but nevertheless, it's still Torah, yeah. No. The word medrash is not so difficult to translate. It comes from investigation, to be doresh. We investigate the meaning of a text. So, you know, that doesn't convey any authority one way or the other, you know. You can say that, you know, when I learn something myself, you know, I'm doresh into the meaning of a pasuk. In fact, the truth is there are mefarshim that give their commentaries the name of medrash. The commentary of Rabbeinu Bechaya, which is one of the great Torah commentaries, is called Medrash Rabbeinu Bechaya. So the word Medrash was used even for things that are not the genre of Medrash officially. Well, this is the Rambam's point. The Rambam's point is that Midrash conveys spiritual truths, but it is not always intended to be literal truths. I mean, that's the Rambam's Chiddush, and that was the approach of Maharal, Ramchal. In fact, maybe this deserves a whole series of talks in and of itself. The symbolic language of Medrash. And that's a very, very important lesson. Again, you see the point here. It's not that a Medrash is not true. A Medrash is true. But truth exists on different levels. This is what the Rambam is teaching us in the Hakdama to Perek Chelek. And that's, when I say Medrash, I also include the Haggadah in the Gemara. Right, there's Medrash and there's Haggadah, but you know, they follow the same types of rules. Unfortunately, Haggadah is often, people don't pay attention to it. You know, in the yeshiva, for example, you're learning Gemara, and the Gemara has many halachic discussions, and every once in a while you have an Haggadic break for 1, 2, 3, 4 pages, sometimes even more than that. In a typical advanced yeshiva, that's skipped. The Rebbe says, we're going to skip it. We're going to skip these 4 pages. You can learn it by yourself because it's not a halachic discussion, and therefore we're not going to spend our time. And it's very unfortunate. The Vilna Gaon writes that in Haggadah are the deepest secrets of the Torah. Or the way Rav Kook described it, the halacha is the body of Judaism, and the Haggadah is the neshama. Medrash and Haggadah, I'm using kind of interchangeably, is the neshama. The values of Judaism come from the Haggadah. The practical ways you have to live, that comes from the halacha, yeah.
Just an aside, the reason we have to not exist without the Old Testament.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's very, very correct. The new builds on the old. Of course, we don't consider the building to be a good addition. But yeah, for sure. The foundation is this. I mean, one has to know that. I mean, again, Yeshka is a complicated figure because a lot of the theology of Christianity came much later. Meaning, if you would have asked Yeshka, how did he perceive himself? You know, that would have been a complicated question. It wouldn't necessarily be the way he was perceived at a later time. Okay, so we're almost finished, so let's just at least spend a few minutes on our topic. but again, forgive me for the digression, but I thought it was an interesting thing that a lot of people are not aware of. Again, we've been talking a lot about being motzi somebody. So I just want to mention one interesting halacha. You may have heard that... Well, we know for Kiddush. I say Kiddush, the bottom line is that even if I've made Kiddush a lot of times, I can make it again for someone who didn't hear Kiddush, because Kol Yisrael Arevin Zeh L'Zeh, since every Jew is responsible for every other Jew, so if you didn't hear Kiddush, I'm still obligated. So the fact that I heard Kiddush and then my wife didn't hear Kiddush, no problem, I can make it again. Or she can make it, but if she doesn't want to make it, I can make it for her. But you may have heard an interesting thing, that's not true for Havdalah. That when they make Havdalah in Shul, you may notice, I'm not sure, but you may notice that they will often make a point of having an unmarried person, a single person, make Havdalah in Shul rather than a married person, because the married person will say, I gotta go home and make it for my wife. Now, you may ask the question, what's the big problem? Let him make Havdalah and Shul for himself, and then he'll make it for his wife. After all, he could have done that at Kiddush. If he was in Shul for a Shabbos morning Kiddush, and he made Kiddush to eat, and his wife was not in Shul, when he goes home, he can make Kiddush again. So why can't? What's the problem with Havdalah? Why would there be a Hakpada, and indeed, the Halacha says such a Hakpada, that the Havdalah in Beis Knesset should be said by an unmarried person. So let me explain what the issue here is. We know for sure that women are chayavos in Kiddush, because even though Kiddush is a mitzvah asei, shazman grama, but we know, if you'll remember, we compare Zohar and Shomor were said b'dibur echad. Zohar is the positive commandment of Kiddush. Shamar is the negative of not doing malacha. So Chazal have a drasha, whoever has the negatives of Shabbos also has the positives. So there's no question, a woman and a man are equal when it comes to Kiddush. However, there actually is a machlokes if that includes Havdalah. Some Rishonim, a minority, actually say a woman is not chayeves in Havdalah because it's a mitzvah saseh shezman gerama and it's not nichlal in the Zohar v'shamor, which is going on Kiddush. Others say a woman is chayeves in Havdalah because the same way Zohar and Shamor obligates her b'chnisato, that in the beginning of Shabbos, to honor the Shabbos, it also obligates her b'yitziyato. Now, so there's actually a machlokas. Does a woman have to say Havdalah? Now, let's say she's by herself. So what's the halacha going to be? The halacha is going to be that she says Havdalah by herself. Reason? Because if she's chayeves, she has to do it. And if she's not chayeves, she's allowed to do a mitzvah saseh shezman gerama, just like taking a lulav. So, bottom line is, we have a machlokes if a woman is chayevet in Havdalah, but even if she's not chayevet, she's allowed to do it, therefore, she should do it. But, here's the problem. If I, as a man, was yotze Havdalah, and now I'm going to say it for her. If she's not chayevet, my saying it again is a bracha levatala. Because she has the right to do a mitzvah asei shezman gerama that she's exempt for. But I don't have the right to be motzi her in it. Because if it's not a chiyev, it's a bracha levatala. So if we knew that she was chayeves in Havdalah like she is chayeves in Kiddush, there'd be no problem with the husband doing it again. That's why Kiddush there's no problem, because she's chayeves in Kiddush. But since Havdalah is a safek, so in such a situation, he should not make the bracha if he was already yotze, because for him, to say a bracha on a mitzvah that a woman is patura from would be a bracha levatala from his perspective. So the bottom line, therefore, actually is, if a husband was yotze with Havdalah, his wife should make Havdalah herself. And let me hasten to add, there is absolutely no problem with her drinking the wine. The minhag that a woman does not drink the Havdalah wine is only if somebody else is making Havdalah for her. When a woman, whether widowed, divorced, or college student, or her husband already made Havdalah, whatever it would be, when a woman makes Havdalah for herself, there is no question that she does drink the wine, right? So people, don't worry about a beard. Say again? Yeah, so there are different reasons. Some say that the chait of the Eitz Hadas brought death into the world, and the woman was the one who gave Adam the Eitz Hadas, and the wine, according to some opinions, the Eitz Hadas was a grape, was a vine, so therefore she should not participate as in the thing that she caused death to come into the world after Shabbos, yeah. So the minhag is, this is a minhag, the minhag is that when a man makes Havdalah for a woman, for his family, she should not drink from the Havdalah wine, although she would drink from the Kiddush wine. So again, as I say, part of it is it's connected to the idea that the Eitz Hadas, according to some opinions, was a vine, and the woman caused Adam to be nichshol. Yeah, that's the main reason. That's the main reason. But that's a minhag again. And I want to point out this idea that a woman grows a beard is above a ma'aseh. That's not that bichlal is not emes. But as I say, if a woman makes Havdalah herself, she absolutely drinks the wine. She must drink the wine under those circumstances. So this is the nafkamina. Do you see the difference between the Kiddush and the Havdalah? A woman is 100% obligated in Kiddush, so the husband can do it again and again and again and again. If she's not chayevet in Havdalah, she could do it, but for him it would be a bracha levatala. And since it's a suffix, if she's chayevis, it's better for him not to do it if he was yaitse. If he wasn't yaitse, then of course he can do it for her, because it's not a bracha levatala, because he has to say it for himself as well.
I was told that if I'm making Havdalah for myself, I don't use a...
Okay, so that's another shayla. Maybe I'll have to talk about it next week. There are those that say that even if a woman makes Havdalah, she does not make the bracha over Eish. Over Eish. There is such a shita. We actually don't paskin that way. We actually paskin, unless, you know, if you have a minhag, that's your minhag. But lahalacha, we paskin a woman does make the bracha over Eish as well. But you are correct. There is such a view. Okay, you all have a good week, and thank you for coming.